Military police got back into the compound of the $2.5 million embassy complex at dawn. Before that, a platoon of Viet Cong were in control.
The Tet Offensive, launched in the pre-dawn hours of January 31, 1968, would prove to be a major turning point in the Vietnam War.
This is where the Viet Cong raiders broke in. They had explosives, their purpose apparently to destroy the embassy.
What exactly had happened and what it meant would take some time to sort out. All that was clear at that time was that something startling had occurred and that the U.S. was up against a way more formidable opponent than most Americans had previously believed. I'm David Brown, and from Public Radio International, this is LBJ's War, an effort to understand why Lyndon Johnson, a president of enormous talent and skill, failed to extricate himself and the nation from a war he knew to be a quagmire in the making, almost from his first days in office. In this sixth and final episode, what happens when a president with a penchant for secrecy wages war without the full knowledge and consent of the public?
It's Tet, the Oriental New Year. And it's a new war. The Viet Cong simultaneously attacked just about every major city and town in South Vietnam. In one day, they increased the scope of the war dramatically.
With the stalemate that had descended on the ground in South Vietnam, leaders in Hanoi concluded that they needed to do something to break that stalemate.
Lien Hang Thi Nguyen teaches the history of the Vietnam War at Columbia University.
And in Vietnamese communist words, they called that they needed to score a decisive victory in 1968 before Washington could expand and escalate the war to Hanoi's detriment.
I really don't think in any realistic way that anybody on the top figured that they could throw 500,000 Americans into the sea.
Sam Adams was a CIA analyst stationed in Vietnam.
But I think basically what they were trying to do was jolt American public opinion right before the American elections. And in my view, they succeeded in spades in doing that.
The shock of Tet was just enormous.
Barry Zorthian was the man in charge of press relations for the U.S. military command, known as MACV in Saigon.
You know, that front page of the Washington Post that next morning with the pictures of the brand new American embassy, the old symbol of everything, not destroyed, but pretty well damaged, and dead people all around it, had to be one of the great, great shocking, traumatic events in Washington.
I think it shows two things, Mr. President. First, that they have more power than some credit them with.
This is Johnson's Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, briefing the president the morning after the attack. His report is not encouraging.
And my guess is that we will inflict very heavy losses on them, both in terms of personnel and materiel, and this will set them back some, but that after they absorb the losses, they will remain a substantial force. I don't anticipate that we'll hit them so hard that they'll be knocked out.
With his usual crisp command of the facts, McNamara already has a handle not only on the military side of what's happened, but on its likely political impact in the U.S.
It's largely a propaganda effort. I mentioned our people across the country this morning will feel that they're much stronger than they had previously anticipated they were. And in that sense, I think they gain. The question in my mind is how to respond to this. My own feeling is that we ought to depend upon our ability to inflict very heavy casualties on them as our proper response and as the message we give to our people.
While McNamara is focused on military response, the president's first concern, characteristically, is with damage control on the home front.
I think that one thing we ought to do is try to keep Westmoreland in the news out there every twice a day.
I quite agree.
William Westmoreland is the general in command of American forces in Vietnam and a dependable advocate for the war effort back home. Just a few months earlier, LBJ had brought him back to reassure the country on the progress of the war.
I don't think they get enough information. We all pulled in, and I meet with them once every 2-3 months.
Yeah.
You meet with them once a month if it's something big, but if you'll remember, you used to see it almost daily.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And I think it shows the difference, and I think in this campaign year, the other...
Johnson sounds almost wistful here, remembering the halcyon days when the press and the White House were largely in agreement on the war. Barry Zorthian again.
If you check the polls up through that November, even though there were critical press stories, and a lot more of them than you would have liked, the press by and large supported the basic effort. And the American public, maybe as a result of the press, supported the basic effort until Tet. Tet was what reversed it.
As a fuller picture of the attack began to emerge, Secretary McNamara's morning-after assessment for the president would prove to be remarkably accurate. In military terms, the Tet Offensive was a defeat for the North. Politically, it would prove to be a public relations disaster for the president.
This was really the most dismaying month I ever remember in the White House, this month of February.
Harry McPherson was LBJ's chief speechwriter.
There were competing views all over the place. Our embassy in Saigon and MACV, the military operation in Saigon, was telling us that we had really beat the hell out of the enemy, that they had taken tremendous casualties, and they had. They lost an enormous number of people, a lot of people who were in the infrastructure in South Vietnam and were living apparently normal lives while being VC agents, came out into the open and were either killed, captured, or at least identified, chased out of their villages.
At the same time, McPherson says,
the negative was essentially here in this country. It was the feeling on the part of a vast numbers of Americans that particularly after Westmoreland had come back in the fall of the year before and said that things were really looking good, and I believe they used the expression light at the end of a tunnel, that after all of that and after the tremendous commitment for 3 years, air power, 550,000 men and all the rest of it, that this crowd was still able to mount a major offensive. The terrible quality of the war in Vietnam came home to people. It appeared that these guys didn't want to quit at all and were never going to quit, that our crowd was as caught off guard as ever.
On the eve of the Tet attacks, the United States intelligence had received reports that there was a lot of enemy activity in the area around the cities and towns.
Again, Professor Hang Nguyen.
But LBJ, as well as everyone on the ground, did not believe the communist forces would be able to launch an attack of that scale and take advantage of the Tet Truce in 1968. So in that sense, the United States was surprised by the Tet Offensive.
For the first time, it became clear to the country that the White House had either underestimated the strength and resolve of the North, or, more damagingly, knew the truth but kept it from the American public. Either way, the president's credibility on the war took a hit from which it would never recover.
Good morning, Mr. President.
Hi, Jack.
We need guidance this morning, sir, on how much weight to give press reports from Seoul.
3 days after the Tet attack, an unsuspecting wire service reporter calls the president on another story out of Asia, but finds it's Vietnam that's on his mind. And not in a good way.
Absolutely. Your press is lying like drunken sailors every day. First thing I waked up this morning was trying to figure out, after watching the networks, reading the morning papers, was how can we win, possibly win, and survive as a nation and have to fight the press's lies.
The perception that Tet was a defeat for the U.S. is especially galling.
And I don't admit that this is a communist victory. And I don't think anybody but a goddamn communist admits it. We think we've killed 20,000. We think we've lost 400. We think that, of course, it's bad to lose anybody, any one of the 400. But we think that the good Lord has been so good to us that it is a major, dramatic victory. And I think what would have happened if I'd lost 20,000 and they'd lost 400? I ask you that.
Oh, it's been terrible.
And I just think they're using us, just playing games around us. And nearly everybody I talk to tries to find out what's wrong with our boys, our country, our leadership, our men. Our president's a liar, or Westmoreland's no good.
Eventually, the fury is spent. LBJ turns from angry to woeful at how much worse his troubles are than those of his North Vietnamese counterpart.
I'm trying to protect my country, and they're all whipping me. Not a son of a bitch said a word about Ho Chi Minh. He hadn't been elected to nothing. He's a dictator if there ever was one. Nobody ever elected him like I went was elected by a convention and by the people. But he hadn't never heard an ugly speech by him. Not even strong.
LBJ never seemed to feel he had the confidence of the American public.
Barry Zorthian again.
He wasn't sure of his public posture. And therefore, he wasn't sure he could call on the American public to take on a war. Deliberately and consciously. As a result of that, the American people were never involved. They were told to go about their normal lives and prosperous lives while we were fighting a war, this nasty little war out in Asia. Then suddenly you turn around, we've got 500,000 people out there and more on the way, no limit to it. And the story broke that Westmoreland won 200,000 more troops. We were going to hit 700,000. And that's what I think Walter Cronkite reacted to in part. That feeling of just a quagmire, that there was no end to it.
In mid-February, the venerable CBS News anchorman Walter Cronkite had gone out to Vietnam to make his own assessment of the impact of the Tet Offensive. Upon his return, the most trusted man in America, as he was then called, had a grim report for the nation.
To say that we are mired in stalemate seems the only realistic, if unsatisfactory, conclusion. On the off chance the military and political analysts are right, in the next few months we must test the enemy's intentions in case this is indeed his last big gasp before negotiations. But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
For Johnson, the negotiations urged by Cronkite had proved an elusive and ultimately unattainable goal. He had tried repeatedly, and he believed sincerely, to initiate talks toward a settlement of the war, but they'd all been ignored or rebuffed. By the time of the Tet Offensive, the president had concluded that only sustained bombing and a stepped-up ground war could get the North Vietnamese to the conference table.
The party leadership did not trust negotiations with the United States.
This again is Hang Nguyen.
They never believed in any of Johnson's public pronouncements, anything that had to do with going anywhere to talk about peace or his plan for South Vietnam. Hanoi viewed LBJ and his predecessors all as warmongering imperialists who would try to maintain, at all costs, a corrupt and submissive anti-communist regime in power in Saigon and keep the country divided. And nothing the Americans would do short of withdrawing their support from Saigon would be acceptable.
And so the president found himself increasingly stuck. An opaque and immovable foe on one side, growing pressures at home to find a way out on the other. In early March, just a week after the Cronkite broadcast, he confided his frustrations to Senator Richard Russell, a longtime mentor and colleague.
I spent 3 hours with Fulbright last night.
That's William Fulbright, the formidable chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
You didn't do much of a Johnson sales job on him, evidently.
No, he's got problems, Dick, that man has.
The main problem Fulbright has is with the Vietnam War. He and Johnson had been colleagues and friends in the Senate, but Fulbright has since emerged as the country's most influential critic of the war, and the friendship is no longer.
I was real worried about talking to Fulbright. I said, Senator, now let's play president a while. What would you do if you were president? Well, he said, I would like to negotiate. I said, well, I would too. Well, he said, why don't you negotiate? And I said, because they won't negotiate. Well, I said, there must be some way to make them negotiate. And I said, well, you tell me. You write me. Tell me how to do it. I don't know how to do it.
The next morning, the president is still stewing about the Fulbright meeting, this time in a call with his Secretary of State, Dean Rusk.
Fulbright says, I want to be consulted. I said, well, now, you've been consulted. We've been here 3 hours. He just goes off then on a tangent and talks about how terrible the war is, how it's tearing our society to pieces and how it's dividing us here and how it's hurting us in the world. I said, I agree to all that. I won't debate any of it. The alternative, though, I believe, if we just pulled up and run out, would be worse.
What's more, the president tells Rusk, Fulbright is not the only senator unhappy with his conduct of the war. Even his old friend Russell had taken him to task in their call the night before.
Russell said, I don't think we know how to fight a war out there. I think you've been a complete failure for 5 years. And I think you're too tender and too much like a woman. You haven't got any guts. And that is about the net of Russell.
In fact, this brutal critique sounds much more like Johnson than Russell. But the point is clear. The president sees himself as under attack from all sides. Too tender for the hawks, too much a warmonger for the doves, and abandoned to plot a course forward with a shrinking group of White House loyalists. Robert McNamara, his Take the Hill Secretary of Defense, has privately admitted to secret doubts about the war and announced his departure to head the World Bank. McGeorge Bundy, also an advocate for standing firm in Vietnam in the early days, has likewise had a change of heart and left the White House. Of the original War Council, only Dean Rusk remains inside as his embattled and increasingly isolated president circles the wagons.
In the end, I believe that he'd cut himself off from all but about four people who agreed with him.
Catherine Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post, had been a close friend of LBJ's, dating back to his days in the Senate.
By then, I'd become disillusioned with the war. I didn't think we could win it, although we'd supported him longer than almost any other paper in the country.
In January, LBJ appointed Washington insider Clark Clifford, also an old friend of Graham's and a longtime supporter of the war, to replace Robert McNamara as Secretary of Defense.
At that point, Clifford came over to lunch. I told him how worried I was. He said, Kay, I am going to take a total look at this. Of course, he did, and he decided that we had to get off the wicket.
I thought that Clifford, because I'd heard him on a couple of occasions, was as strong as any man could be for the war and for the policy we were following.
Harry McPherson, LBJ aide and speechwriter.
It was about, I guess, in the last part of February that I began to talk to Clifford on occasion, and with a sense of astonishment discovered that he was having some real doubts about matters in Vietnam and our policy.
I came into the Pentagon job on March 1st, 1968.
This is Clark Clifford.
And that's when, really, all of the concerns that I might have felt before all began to come to the surface, and I'd push them down here and they'd pop up there. And I'd go home at night and be uneasy and disturbed, and then we'd start again the next day and we'd grind through this business.
The critical point came after several weeks of briefing when Clifford put the question to the Joint Chiefs, who was describing what we could do with a larger force in South Vietnam, whether this would win the war.
That said, now I want to know, what is the military plan for victory in Vietnam? Well, there was no military plan for victory. The Joint Chiefs said, what we must do is just continue to carry on as we are. And we believe that the attrition, ultimately, will become unbearable from this enemy standpoint. So I say, how long? We don't know. 6 months? Oh, no, it can't be done in that period. A year? Well, no. 2 years? 3 years? 4 years? Well, nobody knows. Well, here's this kind of bottomless pit, do you see? We could just be there year after year after year, sacrificing 10,000 American boys a year. And it just didn't add up.
President Johnson did not like to hear opposition to his war policy. What was his reaction to Clifford's doubting?
Terrible. When you spent as much time laboring with this thing as he had, when the judgment of history on his administration was riding on this, on whether it had been right to escalate in Vietnam, this chasm under your feet is a horrible thing. Imagine, Christ, you've put 550,000 Americans out there. You've lost 25,000 of them dead. What if it's wrong?
For 4.5 years, LBJ had waged war and sought peace in Vietnam without success on either score. The Tet Offensive had brought the terrible reality of the war home to an electorate that, for the most part, had not until then fully reckoned with its costs and consequences. On March 31, 1968, 8 weeks after the shock of Tet, Lyndon Johnson, in a reckoning of his own, administered an aftershock.
Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
It's a sad moment in history.
David Halberstam won a Pulitzer for his reporting on the war.
I had a profound sense that the war was in effect over, that it was only a question of when America came to terms with it. So the only question was how much of a toll we were going to take of ourselves and of them before it finally ended. We could not destroy them. They would keep coming. So in a sense, it seemed to me that this was a welcome moment because it meant we were being, as a nation, released from Lyndon Johnson's ego, which had become impaled upon that war.
You remember one of his speeches when he said that we were richer and more powerful than any empire in the history of the world?
The actress and activist Helen Gehagan Douglas served in Congress with LBJ and remained a friend until they broke over the war.
Well, this led him, you see, to believe that we could carry on the Vietnam War and go on with the building of the Great Society at home. He was going to do it. He himself was going to do it. And he had the power to do it in the United States. And we were more powerful than any empire had ever been in the world. And what do you do with your power? Let it sit around on a shelf? Decay? Or do you set things right in the world?
He was very bold about his decisions. He always made them. But he never prepared the country for them.
Joseph Alsop was an influential columnist for the Washington Post and a longtime friend of LBJ.
The essence of leadership is to prepare the country to carry it along with you. I mean, he had the country with him, and it would have been very easy for him to put his critics on the defensive. It would have been very easy for him to create a wholly different atmosphere. It was apparent from the beginning that this was utterly impossible if your rule was that you talk peace while making war.
One thing we might have been able to do in 67 that would have made a difference is to square with the American people.
CIA analyst Samuel Adams.
To go up and say to them, look, this thing is a lot bigger problem than we thought it was. Blood, sweat, and tears. Mobilize the reserves. We're going to have to have another 100,000 troops so we can go and send a couple of divisions to cut off the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And I appeal to you, American people, that this is the thing that has to be done. There is no light at the end of the tunnel right now. There might be later. But they didn't. They temporized. They fiddled around. They tried to make it look we were about to win. And then whammo, we caught with our pants down in the Tet Offensive.
That was the turning point. And Johnson had to say no further.
John Chancellor covered the White House for NBC News and would later anchor its nightly broadcast for a dozen years.
I think that he would not have been forced into the unhappy decision not to run again if the country had been better prepared, the country had better understood what he was doing in Vietnam. And the one great disadvantage Lyndon Johnson had as running this country is that people didn't quite trust him. That sense of uneasiness and mistrust can kill a president. And it did Lyndon Johnson.
In December 1972, Lyndon Johnson visited the campus of the University of Texas at Austin to talk to a government class at the newly minted LBJ School of Public Affairs. The White House years and the terrible trauma of the war had aged him. 6 weeks later, he would be dead of a heart attack at age 64. But on this day, speaking to a group of young people bound for public service themselves, he reflected on his own legacy with a wistful honesty. Nearly five decades later, his words still resonate.
I felt inadequate in many fields. But the greatest inadequacy I felt was my ability to know what was right. A president wants to do what's right. But the things that come to him are balanced just about like that. And you put them on scales and it's pretty difficult to detect which one goes up and down. If they're not questions like that, they shouldn't come to him. So his big job is not doing what's right, but knowing what's right. And in this frightening age in which we live, it's pretty difficult to know what's right.
For Public Radio International, I'm David Brown, and this has been LBJ's War. This episode, the last in the series, was written by Steve Atlas, the executive producer. The series producer is Josh Swartz. Associate producer, Son Son Tam. Creative consultant, Paul Taylor. Researchers, Jason Higgins, Tom Reinstein, and Robert Thompson. Original music by Ellery Kramer. For more info, visit lbjswar.org or find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you've enjoyed the series, please leave us a rating and review in Apple Podcasts and spread the word we're here. Special thanks to the LBJ Presidential Library in Austin, Texas. Major funding for the project has been provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor.